not know that the bacteria had been released on the crowd, or she would undermine the entire operation. Yes, for the good of this operation, Zoya would have to die. It brought a thick mist over his eyes when he made the decision, but once he did make it, he was resolute through his profound sadness. Zoya had the head count of the combatants in the room solidified now. There were 14, plus Fox and her father and Hines. She'd seen another 6 or so men leave in pairs, presumably to search the interior of the castle for anyone they'd missed by locking down the great hall. Now she had to find a way out of here. She looked to her father. He looked right back at her. He appeared sad, sadder than she ever remembered seeing him. He was thinking about her. This she knew for certain. Zoya realized that his remaining softness for her, what little left existed, was her way out of here. The gunman working for her father in this room would be reluctant to shoot her if she made a run for it, and her father would be reluctant to give them the okay at least for a moment. She looked across the room towards the center double doors. These were not locked, but they were guarded by 2 men with submachine guns on their chests. Making her way around the tables would have taken too long. This, she knew by tracking the route, she'd have to run. But there was a faster way to the doors. She looked over each table between herself and her goal, and then she moved her hands slightly on the table, covering up a small, thin steak knife. This, she slipped under the cuff of her track top, and the elastic there held it firmly in place against her forearm, with the handle across the palm of her hand. She took a breath to prepare herself and looked back over to her father, and then her heart sank. He was standing from his chair now, his eyes on her. There was no doubt in her mind he'd seen her take the knife and likely figured out exactly what she was going to do. Which meant she had to do it now. Zoya leapt up and onto the big round table, raced across it over dirty dishes and crashing wine glasses, vaulted over the people sitting on the far side, and landed on the floor. She was up onto the second table an instant later, her legs kicking between those seated there. Screams and shouts erupted from the men and women at the banquet. Back on the floor now, she vaulted over a seated lady from the Canadian Intelligence Services and took another 2 steps across this table, then landed on the floor a third time. Behind her, she heard her father shout into the microphone on the stage. "Kill her!" The last table she ran around instead of over, knowing her surprise had been lost and her pattern had been established. But she was lightning fast, and the 2 men at the door had just got their weapons pointed towards her as she executed a diving forward roll. Gunfire cracked, but the rounds had gone above her, and she snapped back up in front of the men, stabbing one through the throat as she used her momentum to crash into the other, knocking him out through the doors. She fell with him and slammed down hard onto the wooden floor, and as men shouted behind her in the great hall, she got up and made a left and began running for her life up the main corridor. Court and Zack had arrived first at the rectory on the ground floor, the rally point where they'd met Jenner and his team. Court had just begun looking down the main corridor towards the great hall when he heard screams, shouting, and then shooting from that direction. He went prone in the corridor, expecting to see someone trying to escape, and then the middle doors flew open, and 2 bodies came flying out and slammed onto the ground. The first person up was Zoya, he quickly saw, and she turned in his direction, away from the main exit, and began running up the corridor. Behind her, the man on the floor rolled onto his side and began to aim his submachine gun at her back. Court shot him twice in the chest from 30 yards. Quickly, 2 more men came rushing into the corridor, and both Court and Zack fired at them, killing one outright and sending the other stumbling back into the great hall with wounds to his legs and feet. Court went up to his knees and moved back into the rectory, keeping his head and rifle out in the corridor, ready to fight off other threats. Zoya saw him ahead. She dove to the ground and landed on her hip, slid on the flooring right past him, and crawled into the room behind him. Court pulled his Glock 19 pistol and handed it to her. She spun back to her left and aimed up the corridor. Zack stood behind her. As he also trained his rifle out the doorway and down the corridor, he said, "Player 3 has entered the game." Jenner and his team arrived seconds later, and Zoya gave them her intelligence through breath labored by her activity of the last minute.
"Like 13,
Maybe 15 enemy left in there, I think. Plus Fox, my father, and that big freak. First and third doors are wired with explosives. The middle one is clear, but guarded.
Jenner asked, what about the hostages?
A few dead. 6, 8, maybe. The rest are seated or lying on the floor. My father and Fox are on the stage.
She looked at the other men.
I want a rifle.
Zack said, armory, second floor, left off the main staircase, third door on the right.
Lorenzi offered to escort her up there. She handed Court his Glock back. She took Lorenzi's sidearm, and quickly she and the ground branch operator disappeared in the dark corridor, running in the opposite direction from the great hall.
Jenner said, Anthem's a tough chick, but is she a shooter?
Court said,
she saved my ass a time or two. Good enough. 7 of us now. We're going to hit that room, boys.
How you want to do it?
Zack asked. Jenner had a plan.
We do a blow and go. We move up the corridor, go to the first set of doors, set a grenade to trigger the explosives there, and then breach as a team through the smoke.
Zack said,
so, straight up the middle, just like at the church.
Court kept his eyes on the doors down the corridor. Sarcastically, he mumbled,
Plan A didn't work, so let's try Plan A. You two hot shits got a better plan?
Jenner barked.
Zack said, there's a dining room on the first floor, at the back over the ground floor kitchen, just behind the great hall.
It had a dumbwaiter.
Saw it earlier.
Big enough for us to get into? Court asked.
You, no problem. Me, it'll be tight, but I can do it.
Court said, Zack and I can gain access to the kitchen. We breach the great hall on countdown, take out Zakharov, Fox, and Hines, mount the stage to get overwatch on the armed combatants. Simultaneously, you guys hit through the center door, split left and right, wall flood across the room.
Jenner thought a moment. Plan is approved, but you don't get Hightower. I'm going to have to split into 2 units. I want Zack as my other unit leader since Travers is walking wounded.
Hightower said,
Hoo-yah.
Court realized it was sarcasm, but he doubted Jenner did.
So I go alone?
Thanks, Jenner.
Negative. Take Anthem. You just said she's a badass.
Court didn't want Zoya anywhere near her father, because he did not want her to be the one to kill him. But the 4 ground branch men had been training and operating together for years. He couldn't pull one of their number away before they did an extremely dangerous blow-and-go on a room full of hostages and gunmen. He saw no alternative to Jenner's plan.
Jenner said, We go as soon as Lorenzi and Anthem get back.
Chapter 65 Zakharov stood on the stage, fuming because of his daughter's escape. Slowly he turned to Fox, standing at his side.
Pick an American, senior executive. Walk him out into the corridor and shoot him in the head.
Fox looked to John Hines and motioned towards a man at one of the American tables in the center of the room. Whispering to him, he said,
Dark hair, 50s. The one who looks like he's about to try something. You see him?
I see him, sir.
Bring him up.
Right away.
Hines stepped off the stage and up to the table, slammed a hand down on the man's shoulder, then led him back to the stage to stand in front of Zakharov.
Name?
Seekins. J. Seekins.
Your title?
Assistant to the Deputy Director of Operations.
He said it proudly, albeit with some nerves evident in his voice. The Russian smiled.
So, you work for Matthew Hanley?
Yes, I do.
Very good.
With a nod to Fox, Hines turned the man for the double doors, and Fox followed, pulling his Beretta pistol discreetly from his jacket as he walked behind the condemned man. Fox said,
You are free to go. Tell your friends the room is wired for explosives. If they try anything, everyone dies.
Seekins was unsure, but after a shove from Hines, he began walking out into the main corridor. He made it 5 feet before Fox fired once into the back of his head, sending him pitching forward onto the wooden floor. Court had seen the man step out, but he didn't see the shooter because of the angle into the great hall. The other men had seen it too.
Travers said, They're killing hostages because we're in here fighting back. That one's on us.
Jenner transmitted over the radios now.
Lorenzi, they are shooting hostages. Say again, they are shooting hostages. Get your ass back here. We have to breach now.
We encountered hostiles on our way back. Seemed to be a 2-man patrol. We've eliminated them, and we'll be on you in 2 mics.
Zoya and Lorenzi returned 2 minutes later. She was now armed with a SIG MPX submachine gun, and she wore a Glock 17 on her hip. Court informed her that she would go with him, back up to the first floor to try to hit the great hall from behind, and soon they were moving off in that direction. Fyodor Zakharov had relocated his guard force around the room, knowing that Zoya would be linking up with whoever was out in the hall and telling them everything she'd seen inside. He and Fox had also left the stage, and now they stood with Hines at the locked side door that led to a stairwell down to the 2 below-ground levels of the castle. His men stood more vigilant than before, and for this he was glad, but he worried he did not have enough guns here to stave off an attack from any large force. He ordered Fox to pick up a submachine gun from a dead security man. Then he pulled his pistol and held it in his right hand while he looked at his watch. It had been only 2 hours since the plague had been released. He needed to stall and to keep stalling. He also saw that it was time for his next speech. He talked for 10 minutes on his sat phone to the security officials outside about war crimes committed by the Five Eyes organizations, focusing his ire on the United States and the United Kingdom. It was a short but rambling speech, and he promised another soon. When this was done, he sat down at a table of CIA executives.
"Long night, eh, chaps?" he said. "But tomorrow you will all be free. No one else needs to die, on either side."
DCIA Fred Capshaw was at the table.
"What side do you even represent? You're English, working with Russians. But there is no way Moscow sanctioned any of this."
Zakharov leaned towards the man. With a smile, he said,
"I am a rogue elephant, sir. I need no sanction."
He waved his hand around.
"Only men, materiel, and a plan."
"You're insane. You won't change a thing with your crazy speeches."
"We'll see,"
the Russian said with a bored shrug.
"We'll see if anything changes when this is over. You destroyed my plague, but you did not destroy my passion."
He stood up and walked away.
Cort and Zoya scooted down the narrow dumbwaiter. It was tight with their weapons and ammo, but they still had to use their arms and legs to keep from falling to the ground floor.
Cort fought the urge to press with his left hand, and he used his left elbow instead, which was as painful as it was inefficient. Once they finally made it down into the kitchen, they brought their weapons to bear, but saw no targets. The rear exit was only 25 feet away, and they could see an explosive charge up against it, wired tightly against the door. Quietly and slowly, they picked their way through the kitchen, stepped through the larder room, and then entered a hallway that seemed to point in the direction of the great hall. Cort knelt in the dim light, his rifle in front of him, while Zoya stood behind. He keyed his mic.
"Violator in position."
Jenner spoke for the 5 men out in the corridor on the far side of the great hall.
"We're in position. We will breach when the shooting starts."
"Understood."
Together, Cort and Zoya moved forward up the hall, their eyes in their weapon sights, scanning as they stepped. They made a turn and saw the stairs up to the stage just 20 feet in front of them, while on their left were tables full of men and women in formal attire. He leaned into Zoya's ear.
"Please, let me handle your father."
Zoya began moving forward.
"Move out," she ordered.
With just a brief pause for a frustrated sigh, Cort shot forward, past Zoya, but knew she'd stay on his heels. They'd be exposed on the stage, but they were counting on drawing the attention of all the gunmen in the room just long enough for Jenner, Hightower, and the others to push in and start eliminating threats from behind. More than anything, however, was Cort's desire to drop Zakharov the instant he saw him. He wasn't going to give Zoya the burden of killing her father. She'd probably hate him forever for depriving her of this, but he knew it was the right thing to do. But when he raced up onto the stage, he instantly saw that it was empty. Zakharov had moved. A shout came from across the room as the crowd saw the armed man and woman charging onto the stage. Cort looked out over the great hall, but saw no obvious threats in that first moment. Knowing he and Zoya would likely be shot dead instantly, he fired his rifle into the far wall, as gunfire was the cue for the others to hit the room. The middle doors flew open 40 yards opposite him, and Cort shouted to Zoya,
"Get down!"
As gunfire erupted from the back of the hall, everyone at the tables dove flat on the ground. Jenner and Lorenzi moved quickly to the right, back to the wall, while Hightower, Greer, and Travers went left. Immediately, Hightower spotted a man aiming a submachine gun at the stage. He was 100 feet across the room, but Zack shot him in the right cheek, blowing half his face off and spinning him to the ground. Lorenzi found the second target, a man in the middle of the room who did not drop with the hostages, but instead whipped his submachine gun around towards the gunfire behind him. Lorenzi fired a burst at the man, knocking him back onto a table, the linens there instantly stained with red. Greer fired at the third target, a huge blonde man with a handgun by a small door on the far side of the room. He'd been forced to rush his shot, however, and his rounds went wide. Before he could engage again, he was under fire from his right, so he swiveled to take on that threat, while the big man disappeared through the door, and several others raced through behind him. Jenner kept moving to the right, scanning his sector, trusting Lorenzi to do the same. He saw an armed man close to the stage and fired at him, knocking him down. Another man stood up from behind one of the bars along the wall, aimed a weapon, and Jenner shot him dead as well. He then shifted his aim to the right, scanning for targets, but only saw a flash of light in the far corner of the room before his head snapped back and his world went black.
"Jenner's down!"
Lorenzi shouted over the network, but the gun battle was too fierce to stop to render aid. Court and Zoya had each fired at one target. Zoya hit a man in the thigh who disappeared behind a group of hostages, and Court hit a man in the lower abdomen, but he was on the ground out of view behind a table and possibly still in the fight. Zoya had seen Hines and a group of armed men racing through the side door, and she leapt to her feet, launched off the stage, and went in pursuit of him. Court climbed to his knees, still engaging targets in the room, but he shouted to her,
"No, wait!"
She did not listen, just kept running through the crowd as everyone began to climb to their feet and stampede for the center exit. Court leapt off the stage, picking off gunmen one by one, who were all struggling to orient themselves to the many angles of this small but disciplined attacking force. The Great Hall cleared out in under 1 minute, save for the American operators, the wounded, and the dead. Jenner was in the latter category, shot through the mouth, and Greer had taken a subgun round through the right biceps that had him on the floor while he tied it off with a compression bandage, using his left hand and his teeth. By now, Travers had lost enough blood out of the wound in his right leg that his fight was over, as he could barely stand, and though Lorenzi had shot three Russians grouped closely together, he took a bullet through his right shin and his left foot in the process. Zack Hightower had killed 5 men in the last minute, all with a single magazine. He reloaded his rifle now, ready to head towards the doorway where Hines and some other men had disappeared, but he heard a voice behind him that spun him around. It was Hanley. He held the shotgun in his hand.
"Where's Zakharov?"
"What the hell are you doing here, sir?"
He saw Brewer behind Hanley now, a terrified look on her face.
What a shit show, he thought.
All the smart suits were running away, and these two nitwits were running in.
"I'm helping you," Hanley said. "Brewer will help, too."
Brewer seemed to Zack like she had no interest in helping anyone but herself, but she was here, a pistol held low in her hand. Zack sighed.
"They went into that stairwell. It seems to lead down to the basement."
Hanley started moving for it.
"Let's go."
"Wait, Violator and Anthem have already..."
"Let's go!"
Hanley shouted, and he headed through the doorway. Zack ran after the two of them, overtaking them and making it into the stairs before them. With his weapon light shining, he led the way down. Court and Zoya arrived at the first subterranean lair without seeing or hearing anyone. Both wondered where the hell the squirters thought they were going down here, unless their plan was to use some other staircase to make their way back up to ground level. This was the dungeon level. It was a poorly lit warren of rooms, formerly cells, common spaces, and barracks for the guards, now mostly used for storage. There were dozens of rooms where people could hide. Heavy metal gates hung in archways, held up by thick rope. A wine cellar had been built where prisoners once had been stockaded, and the entire area smelled to Court like it was right on Loch Ness and not 150 feet above it. The two of them moved together for a while, until they reached a circular room with 3 archways leading out of it. Zoya touched Court on his shoulder. We have to split up. Court was afraid of this. Tactically, it made sense. There was too much area to cover to find anyone hiding down here before they could escape. But he could only now pray that he was the one who came across her father first. He reached out with his good hand and took her head in it, drew her to him. Softly, he said, "Be careful," and he kissed her. "You too," she said, and then, "My father, he's mine." She turned away and disappeared in the dark to the right. Court chose the left side passage. He transmitted this decision over his mic, but he didn't think anyone still alive upstairs could have possibly heard him down here below ground. Hightower, Brewer, and Hanley heard the garbled transmission, and they pieced it together, Anthem right, Violator left. The three moved slowly and quietly out of the dim stairwell and into the dungeon area. They arrived at the circular room 1 minute after receiving Violator's call, and they continued forward, under the middle arch. Fyodor Zakharov followed behind the two sleepers still alive as they pushed on through the dungeon towards the secret door that led down to Loch Ness. They knew the way, but they had a stop to make along the way first. Also, they were slowed somewhat scanning with their flashlights, checking the placement of the daisy chain of explosives that had been attached around the dungeon level. Zakharov had sent Fox and Hines off in another direction to check the explosives there. The wires were supposed to be out of the pathways, running instead along the walls, but the men who wired the subterranean level had a lot of ground to cover and little time, so it was an obvious rush job. Everyone knew that accidentally kicking a wire would set off the cigarette pack-sized amount of C4 the wire had been attached to, and this would kill anyone 10 yards in any direction, so they did what they could to avoid this eventuality. The Russian mercenaries hadn't brought enough C4 to drop the entire castle, not by a long shot, but a timer had been attached to one of the devices, and all the devices were wired together. It was set for 10 minutes, but now Zakharov wanted to find the device with the timer on it and speed the countdown to 5 minutes before getting into the passageway to the water, detonating 30 small but powerful charges down here in the lower levels to eliminate any pursuers. Behind him he heard a distant echoing voice. "Papa! Papa! I'm coming for you!" Zakharov felt the twinge of fear run down his back now as he kept moving forward with the others. Chapter 66. Court moved quickly up a hallway, checking each dungeon cell with a flash from the light hanging on his rifle. Some rooms were storage now, others empty, and some rooms in this subterranean warren seemed to serve no purpose but to lead to more rooms. He flashed his weapon light on, then back off, moved forward a few feet to cover, and did it again. Over and over. It was not the fastest way to move, but it did expose him to the least amount of danger. Or so he thought. He knelt down behind a row of old steel box fans in the arched stone corridor, held his rifle up, and flashed the light. Just past an archway with a massive steel gate above it, suspended there by thick rope tied to a metal hook in the floor, he saw a large room and, from the quick look he gave it when the light was on, he could tell there were several mirrors in there, because the flash reflected back on him. He was distracted by the bright light in his face for a few seconds, rubbed his eyes, and then squinted, flashing again but towards the floor to avoid the reflections. This time, he could see movement in the room, a shadow streaking right to left in the dim. Court grabbed a flashbang grenade hooked to his belt, pulled the pin, and tossed it underhanded into the room. He ducked down quickly to avoid the blast, and as soon as the distraction device erupted, he rose and ran into the room with his rifle held high. And as he entered the room, he realized the flashbang had been a mistake. The device instantly started a fire in a collection of old, dusty, and unframed oil paintings, blueprints, and maps stacked in piles and leaning haphazardly along the wall. Shit. The last thing he wanted was to be stuck down here in this dungeon in a fire. He looked for something to extinguish the fire with, turning to the corner on his right and shining a light to see what he could find. And then he realized he had been wrong before. This was the last thing he wanted. There, 3 feet away and closing fast, was John Hines. Behind him, he caught a glimpse of Fox running under a metal gate over another archway that led out of the room, a subgun in his hands.
Court got a shot off, but his weapon had already been knocked to the side by Hines. A bullet ricocheted around the room with an angry, multi-note shriek.
The two men crashed into the hard stone floor, rolling up next to the burning paintings, and Court's rifle sling slipped off his head as the weapon slid away. He struggled up to his knees and started to reach for his pistol, but didn't get it out before Hines grabbed his wounded hand and wrenched it to Court's left. This sent him down on his back in agony and short-circuited his attempt to pull his gun. Hines got a meaty hand on the pistol's grip and yanked it free of his holster, but Court elbowed the man's hand and the pistol spun away as well. The fire behind Court against the wall was growing. He could feel the heat, and through the flickering firelight, Court saw smoke billowing across the floor. Hines was on his feet now. Court's body still felt broken from his first two encounters with this leviathan of a man, and he knew he had little chance in another round of one-on-one with him.
"We're gonna get to finish our fun after all, mate,"
Hines said with a roar, and he launched forward at Gentry yet again. Court threw a right jab that connected with Hines's chin, but only partially slowed him down. The Englishman threw a swing of his own. Court managed to lean back away from it, but in doing so, he fell down again onto his back. The flames were raging, the smoke thickening by the second as more oil paintings ignited. He rolled over, launched to his feet, and ran unarmed for the tunnel Fox had taken, not in pursuit of the Russian, but instead desperately trying to get away from Hines. He'd just run under the iron gate suspended above by rope attached to the floor, when he felt Hines grab the back of his Kevlar vest and yank him back. Court fell to the ground and spun around to kick at the big boxer, while simultaneously reaching out with both hands to grab something, anything, to fight Hines off with. His left-hand fingertips grabbed a 2-foot-square wooden-framed oil painting that was fully engulfed with flames, and he frisbeed it as hard as he could at his attacker, both to keep from burning himself too badly and to generate as much momentum as possible. He hit Hines square in the face with the burning material, but the broken bones in his hand hurt worse than ever now. The man shouted in shock and fell back, buying Court a moment's time. He rose to his feet and ran again for the archway now, but he noticed flames raging from the ace bandage on his left arm. He took a blow to the back of the head. Hines had thrown something at him, apparently, and he tumbled forward, falling on the ground yet again, now directly under the wrought iron gate suspended over the archway tunnel out of the room. He coughed in the smoke, rolled onto his back, and looked back to Hines, who was rubbing soot out of his eyes. While he did this, Court ran his left arm up and down the old but thick rope holding up the gate above him, and flames immediately began licking upwards towards the ceiling. He then covered his burning bandages with his body, extinguishing the flames, but creating fresh agony as his weight went down on his broken hand. He looked back over his shoulder as he lay on the floor under the iron gate. Hines was approaching, back in the fight now. He always seemed to bounce back. Court rolled on his back, scooted backwards on his elbows, trying to draw Hines closer. The Englishman's big voice boomed in the subterranean room as he advanced, paying no attention to the fire all around him.
"Gotta snap your neck and end this shite now, mate, but you were one hell of a go, I'll give you that."
Court kicked at the man, trying to buy a little more time, but also trying to keep from looking to the rope on his left that, once it burned through, would fly up, sending the iron gate down right through Court's midsection. Hines stepped under the archway now and knelt down with a smile over the wounded American, his face glowing red from the flames. He took Court by the collar, but just as he did, Court brought his knees to his chest and shifted his legs to his left. With all the might left in him, he kicked with both feet into the rope that had been burning fiercely for 30 seconds, and in so doing, he tore away the last of the fibers that had not burned through. Hines smiled as Court's wild kick missed him and hit a burning rope, and then he heard a loud squeaking noise several feet above his head. His eyes met Court's in the firelight. And now, it was Court's turn to smile. The iron gate dropped like a guillotine, and the vertical shanks slammed into Hines's back, penetrating his ribcage, lungs, and heart, exiting out his chest, and slamming him face first into the stone floor. His face just a foot from Court's, blood gushed from his mouth. He choked out one last
Fuck you.
Before he died, a look of astonishment frozen into his wide open eyes. Court climbed to his knees and looked back into the smoky room around the body. His rifle was on the opposite wall in a raging fire, but his Glock pistol was just within reach through the square openings in the gate. He reached in for it next to Heinz's left hip and scooted it with his fingertips back towards him, but when he tried to pull it through the gate, he realized the weapon was just slightly too large to get through. Shit, he said. With his one good hand still on the other side of the gate, he dropped the magazine from the weapon, fired off the round in the chamber, then pulled the slide back a half inch by pushing the grip back on the floor. With his thumb, he pressed the takedown lever on the frame. After he pulled the trigger again, the metal slide slid off the pistol onto the floor. Now Court easily pulled the frame through the opening next to the dead man, then reached back in and grabbed the magazine and the slide, barrel, and slide rod off the floor and brought them out as the heat began to overtake him. Lying on his side, he reassembled and reloaded the pistol, still with one hand, all the while worrying about Zoya, somewhere down here in pursuit of her father. He coughed as he stood with the weapon, then used the flashlight on the rail below the muzzle to light his way forward. He made it only a few feet before he saw a human form lying face down. Closing carefully, he realized it was Fox, and he'd been shot in the left shoulder blade. Court figured the one shot he'd managed to fire, which hadn't been aimed anywhere near Fox, had ricocheted around the room and wounded the man, who'd bled out 50 feet down the tunnel. Just to be certain, though, Court performed a dead check, shooting him in the back of the head. The man had a SIG MPX submachine gun lying next to him, and Court hefted it, slung it around his neck, and pressed on. Fyodor Zakharov set the master timer on the plastic explosive so the entire chain of 30 explosives around the underground portion of the castle would go off simultaneously. He gave himself and the two sleepers with him 5 minutes before detonation, then initiated the countdown on the detonator. He and his men would be far enough down the stairs by then, and he assumed the Royal Scots Dragoons would be down here around that time looking for him. Along with his daughter. Zoya would die, but Zakharov told himself this was something that was long overdue. Once the timer was set, Zakharov shined his flashlight on the two sleepers. Let's get out of here. The men had their pistols aimed down the arched corridor they had used to get here, expecting anyone chasing them to come from that direction. But another passage ran off to their left. It had been completely pitch black inside, until a pair of flashes in quick succession, simultaneous with loud gunshots, sent Zakharov ducking low and spinning his light towards the noise and light. Both sleepers dropped where they stood, shot in the side of the head and neck at a distance of less than 20 feet. Zakharov moved to turn off his flashlight, but before he could, a high beam shined in his eyes. He dropped his light on the floor. Softly, he said,
Zoya, darling, is that you?
It's me.
Zoya flipped off the light on her SIG MPX, allowing the illumination from her father's flashlight, now lying on the floor, to provide the only glow to the bricked room. Zakharov looked at his daughter with a sad smile.
This will be hard for you, he said. I feel your pain. When Fyo died, of course, I blamed myself. I still do, in a way. And that weight has never left me. It will be worse for you, dear, of course, because you are doing this intentionally. You will carry this forever.
With a cracking voice, she said, Don't worry about me, father. I'll be just fine after this. Better than ever, in fact.
Your words are sold out by your emotions, he said. My old eyes can't see in this light, but how are your stress hives right now?
Zoya did not waver. How are yours?
Why don't you put the gun down? There is a way out of here. A secret passage down to the water. We have diving equipment waiting. You and I can go alone, get away. Talk.
She just responded softly again. Not a chance.
You should consider it. In about 4 minutes, this entire dungeon will be a fiery grave for anyone in it.
Zoya looked around the room and saw the small box on the floor next to her father, with wires running out of both sides. The wires continued along the wall on the floor, passing into two corridors.
then I guess I don't have much time. But you have even less.
Chapter 67. Zoya shot a quick glance behind her when she heard gunfire echo up the corridor there, and in that moment, Zakharov shifted his body slightly to the right and lowered his hand closer to his waist.
Across the room, his daughter shifted to the right so that she wasn't in the line of fire of anyone coming up the hall, and she backed herself up to the brick wall. Her father used his left hand, gesticulating with it to take his daughter's attention away from what he was really doing, going for his gun.
He taught her this in picking pockets when she was a little girl, but he hoped she would not be thinking of her childhood right now.
He pointed at the C4 charge.
30 of these, all throughout the lower level. Here, down that passage, the wall next to it there.
It was working. She was watching his left hand, not his right, and his right was partially shielded by the turn of his body. His hand slipped to his waistband, grabbed the pistol, and drew it slowly, while pointing down the corridor to his right.
I'll turn it off, or you can if you want. The timer is on the main device, just down that way. It's not far. You can probably see it from where you are standing if you shine your light.
Zoya did not move her gun from her father's chest, but she flicked her eyes to her right, up the hall he had indicated.
And Fyodor Zakharov pulled his gun. The concussive booms of 2, 3, 4, then 5 gunshots in quick succession came from the hallway behind Zoya on her left, sending her to her knees and hefting the gun in front of her. In the dim light, her father jerked, spun, and staggered backwards against the wall behind him. A pistol in his right hand fell to the floor, and then his body came crashing down forward. She spun the gun towards the hallway just as Kort stepped through, his Glock pistol still sighted on the body lying crumpled across the room, his SIG submachine gun hanging from his chest.
No! Zoya screamed. No! He was mine!
She pointed her gun at Kort, and he lowered his back down to his side.
You son of a bitch! You had no right!
She shouted at him, but he just flipped on the light on his weapon and shined it on the floor.
He said, There are wires running all over this place. They look new.
I fucking hate you!
She shouted.
Later. The wires...
Zoya's head cleared a little, remembering the imminent peril they were in.
C4, 30 bricks, daisy-chained, and on a timer, 3 minutes.
She jerked her head down the corridor.
He said it's down there.
Kort said, What if it's not?
Zoya turned for the passage her father had indicated and started running.
Follow the wires in the other direction, just in case.
Kort ran back up the hall, his light leading the way, following the wires. A group of people appeared at the same intersection where Primakov's body lay, but quickly he recognized them as Hightower, Hanley, and Brewer.
Kort said, C4 all over this place, no time to get back to the stairs. The timer is either back with Zoya or down one of these lines.
Kort shined the wires on the floor and saw that they split and went down passages to the left and right.
Zack said, Well, I guess I can stop worrying about dying from plague.
Hanley took charge.
Zack and I will take this way. You and Suzanne go that way. We engaged some Russians, dropped some, but some others got clear of us a few minutes ago. They're probably still down here somewhere, so keep your guard up.
Kort ran up the passage, Brewer right behind him. But as they ran, she asked,
Where's Zakharov?
Dead.
Where?
In a chamber behind us.
She slowed. Kort stopped and turned to her.
What?
That's where your detonator is,
she said.
Kort winced. Shit, we didn't check the bomb in there.
He turned and began running back, and Brewer followed. 45 seconds later, he knelt over the bomb by Zakharov's body. The dead man's flashlight had burned out, leaving the room completely black, but Kort shined his pistol's weapon light on the device and saw the digital readout that told him this was the master detonator.
Oh boy, he said.
What?
Brewer asked anxiously.
96 seconds.
Can you disarm it?
As he examined the casing, he said,
One-handed, no tools, amped up from combat and beaten half to shit. Sure, Suzanne, no sweat.
Brewer transmitted over the radio, although all the broadcasts had been so choppy as to render them useless for the last few minutes.
Violator is working on the timer. We've got 90 seconds. Everybody get out of the lower levels or find some cover.
Kort heard Brewer moving away from him now.
Except you, Brewer. I need you to hold the light so I can dismantle this.
I don't have a light.
Court handed her the Glock with the high-lumen Surefire on the rail under the barrel.
Step over here to my left. Keep the light pointed on the wall in front of me. That's all the light I need. Do not point that fucking weapon at me. You copy?
Right.
She moved a few steps to the side and lifted the weapon. Court turned back around, adjusting his SIG subgun on his chest, pushing it to the side so he could lean closer over the device. Brewer pointed the pistol at the wall above and in front of Court, but the flashlight's flood gave Court the light he needed to work. He knelt down even farther and picked at the wires in the box on top of the bricks of C4, following them to their terminations.
"Hurry,"
she said. Court hushed her. The bomb seemed pretty straightforward, and he was well-trained on deactivating IEDs like this, but he wanted to make certain there were no trips in the wiring, little fake-outs the bomb maker had installed to ensure that, even if someone tried to dismantle it, nothing would stop the weapon from fulfilling its one sole purpose. Behind him, the light shook, Brewer's nerves. Softly, Court said,
"Hold it steady. It's okay. I need 30 seconds more. Tops. We're gonna be fine."
Suzanne Brewer held the light as steady as possible, which she found challenging because of the adrenaline and emotions coursing through her. How the fuck had she gotten herself involved in combat? Into the middle of a wet operation surrounded by blacker-than-black operators who ran serious risk to herself, the other members of the IC in the building, and the very nature of Five Eyes itself. Standing feet away from a bomb, seconds away from exploding in some dank, godforsaken, foul-smelling basement. She wanted to vomit. This shitstorm was a disaster for Brewer personally and professionally. She would be radioactive now to the 7th floor of Langley, where the top brass worked. Her right hand wavered, fatigue making the muscles in her shoulders twitch and causing the flashlight's beam to move.
"Hold it steady," Violator repeated. "I just about have it."
He knelt huddled in front of her. All his attention was on his work. The realization came slowly to her, but it did come. There was an opportunity here. Anthem and Romantic were still alive for now anyway, but Violator was the main element of Poison Apple and was facing away from her, and she had a pistol trained just 2 feet away from the side of his head. Could she wait for him to dismantle the weapon and then just shoot him?
Hanley said there were still armed Russians down here in the dungeon. All she would have to say was that someone appeared from the dark and fired at them both, but only poor Violator was hit.
Hanley would believe her. Hightower would believe her. She didn't know about that bitch Anthem, but she didn't really care. Hanley would keep her in check if he wanted his precious program to survive. And if he did want to shelve the entire thing when Violator died, well then, so much the better. Could she shoot Violator right now in the head? She asked herself this one more time, and then she realized that in this absolute disaster of an operation, this had turned out to be the most perfect confluence of events she could possibly hope for. Her luck had finally changed, right here, right now, and it would be so easy. Violator looked up from his work, still facing the wall, and heaved a long sigh.
"It's safe?"
"It's safe," he confirmed.
"Excellent."
She shifted aim to the right, putting the front sight on the left temple of the gray man. Violator had just begun to stand when a flash of light and a boom erupted in the room. Court heard the gunshot, thunderous in the stone basement, and then everything went dark. Chapter 68. Quickly, Court recognized that the gun held by Brewer had fallen to the floor, triggering the weapon lights off switch. He rose to his feet and swiveled on his heels, hefting the MPX as he did so. He had his finger on the trigger and his sights rising to the general sound of the gunfire directly behind him. A weapon light in the adjoining room told him where the threat was coming from, and a flash showed him the shooter was still firing. He felt Brewer tumbling into him, then down onto the floor, and he got his barrel over her falling body, just as a third gunshot rang out. Court sighted on the origin of the tactical light and the muzzle flash, and he returned fire, spraying an 8-round burst directly through the archway from where the shot came. Even in the flash of his own weapon, he was unable to see the shooter clearly, but he did register that the form fell back out of the doorway, crashed onto a heavy round table in the middle of the room there, rolled backwards over it, then fell off on the other side, out of his line of sight. He dropped his slung rifle back to his chest and knelt down over Brewer. Before he could even check her, he heard movement out in the hall and then a shout.
"Friendlies, coming in!"
It was Hightower's voice.
"Brewer's hit!"
Court answered back.
"What's your status?"
Court felt around for his Glock, because the light was so bad he was unable to scan her for more injuries. He gave up after a few seconds and lifted Brewer's head. He felt blood on her neck and shoulder. Court answered Zack back.
"Assessing now!"
He spoke to her.
"Brewer."
I'm shot,"
she said weakly. Court looked up in the dark quickly. He could see the glow of Hightower's weapon light as he approached through the next room. He was nearing the table where the attacker fell.
"Hey, Zack, dead check the shooter on the far side of that table."
"Copy,"
Zack said. Dead checks weren't exactly approved in the Geneva Conventions, but for an operator in a close quarters battle situation, it made no sense to walk past an enemy who still might pose a threat. Court felt around for the Glock again and found it. Then he turned on the light, speaking to Brewer.
"We're gonna get you out of here. Just let me roll you to check for more wounds."
He shifted her onto her side. Using the light now, he could see that her Kevlar vest had taken two rounds on the right side of her ribcage, and a third round had slammed into her upper right shoulder, midway between the arm and the neck. It was a solid entry wound with no exit, meaning the bullet was still inside her body.
"Okay, you're gonna be..."
"Shit!"
It was Hightower shouting from the other room. Quickly, Court lifted the pistol up, anticipating a threat, unsure what Zack's problem was. With his light, he could see Zack on the far side of the table, presumably standing over the body there.
"Shit!"
Hightower said again, his voice plaintive now. Hanley appeared behind him.
"What is it?"
Court shouted back. He lowered his gun and used both hands to apply pressure on the gushing wound on Brewer's shoulder. When Zack didn't answer, Court shouted again.
"What is it, Zack?"
Still, Zack didn't answer. Court looked up now, away from Brewer lying on her back on the stone floor.
"Talk to me!"
Court implored now.
"Six, hold fast. Don't come over here."
Now Court let go of Brewer's wound, stood up slowly.
"Why? What's going on? Who did I shoot?"
Zack said nothing.
"Who did I shoot?"
He screamed it now. Matt Hanley answered.
It's Anthem. She's down."
Court moved slowly across the dark room, his knees weakening. After a few steps he ran forward, made his way around the table into the light of Zack's rifle, and dropped to Zoya's side. Her black track top was riddled with holes across her stomach and chest, and he could see blood on the floor around her.
Zack said, "I'll work on Brewer."
Court muttered,
"GSW, right shoulder."
"Copy." Hightower was up and running to Brewer an instant later. Hanley pulled a flashlight and held it over Court. Zoya's eyes were unfixed, like Brewer's, but she was breathing. Her chest heaved rapidly. He hadn't taken a breath himself since he'd seen the holes in her clothes, and when he ripped open her jacket, he was terrified he'd find wounds to her heart and lungs. Instead, he saw a black Kevlar vest, identical to the one Court had put on the armory on the second floor. He breathed a sigh of relief, but continued checking her. He found a wound on her right hip at the pelvis, where she'd taken a single round. He felt around her hip towards her back and discovered the exit wound. Hanley said,
"How bad is it?" "She needs a hospital, but I need to occlude the bleeding first."
Court saw her eyes open and tears stream out. She tried to talk, but he told her to lie still and quiet. She persisted, and finally he leaned forward to listen to her.
"What's that?"
"She was going to kill you,"
Zoya's weak voice croaked. Court moved his hand from her wound, pulled off his dress shirt and then his undershirt, and jammed it hard against her hip to slow the exit wound's bleeding. He put his hand back down on the front of her hip. As he did this, he said,
"No, I gave her my pistol. She was just giving me light so I could dismantle the device."
Zoya shook her head.
No, she said. It was trained on the side of your head.
Kurt looked back towards Brewer, then again towards Zoya. He didn't know what to think. He said,
Look, you're going to be okay. Those across the chest are going to hurt, and your hip is grazed, but you'll be okay.
This was a lie. Her hip wasn't grazed. It was shot pure and simple, but he was trying to put a good spin on things. Especially because he had been the one who shot her. Lights filled the room as a group of Royal Scots dragoons came running in, their rifles out in front of them. Hanley shouted for a medic, and a man with a backpack of first aid supplies ran over and knelt next to Zoya.
She was going to kill you, Kurt, Zoya said again, and then she slipped into unconsciousness.
Kurt looked up to Hanley and saw the older man's jaw fixed in anger. The Scottish military forces rendered aid to the two wounded American women, and within 20 minutes of their arrival, they were on litters being carried to the ground floor. Hanley immediately spread the word that everyone around the castle needed to get to a hospital now to begin a course of antibiotics, and then he was loaded into a U.S. Navy helicopter along with Brewer, Zakharova, Gentry, Hightower, and the surviving Ground Branch men, Travers, Lorenzi, and Greer, who had all been wounded. They were flown west to the USS Forrest Sherman, an Arleigh Burke-class destroyer just off the Scottish coast. Everyone in the group received antibiotic infusions as soon as the Hilo landed, and everyone save for Hightower and Hanley had been wounded, so they all spent time in the sick bay. Kurt's hand was x-rayed, and it was determined that he didn't need surgery, but they put a proper cast on it and supplied him with mild painkillers that made his life a little easier, though all he did was worry about Zoya. The last surviving attendee of the Five Eyes Conference received their first dose of antibiotics 8 hours after the end of the event, virtually the last moment for the incubation period of the strain of plague created by Dr. Wan Jang Mi. These were followed by infusions the following day and a multi-week course of oral medicines. The day after the attack at the castle ended, Matt Hanley stepped into Suzanne Brewer's private room off the sickbay. She was on her back in bed, her neck heavily bandaged, and she wore glasses and stared blankly at the TV. She turned to him with some difficulty.
Hi, Matt. Nice of you to come.
Hanley entered, closed the door, and sat down next to the bed.
They say you'll be fine.
They say I was lucky. Didn't even break any bones. But I don't feel so lucky. My own asset shooting me.
Zoya says you were targeting Gentry.
Brewer chuckled.
Look, she made an honest mistake, I get that. She saw me with the gun and...
Hanley interrupted.
Suzanne, we are not going to talk about this, you and me, ever again. But I want you to understand one thing. If Kurt dies on your watch, and I have any suspicions, any at all, that his death wasn't in the normal course of operations, I send Zach over to your house. You might want to keep that in mind.
Wait, Christ, Matt, you believe her?
Hanley just stared down at Brewer.
Matt, for God's sake, I didn't.
Hanley interrupted again.
I'm not accusing you of anything, although I have an opinion on what Zakharova said. Next time you might be thinking about some little scheme. Do yourself a favor and think about Zach Hightower, and see if that doesn't calm you down a bit.
But...
Hanley waved a hand through the air and left the room. On his way out, he said,
Get better. I want you back at your desk pronto. Poison Apple needs to go back to work soon.
Brewer stared at the ceiling in the low light, wishing that those fucking bombs had ended her interminable misery. Zoya was in surgery during much of the first afternoon, and then overnight she was put in ICU. She was finally rolled into a room around 11 a.m. the next day. Kurt hadn't spoken to her since she'd passed out in the basement, and there was nothing else on earth that he wanted to do more right now. He went in for another round of antibiotics and was given a bottle with 60 pills in it and told to take 3 a day. After he asked about her, the doctor told him Anthem had been moved to a room. Kurt was given directions, and he descended a ladder and followed a passageway, but when he turned a corner to the room, he saw Zach Hightower standing there, wearing a U.S. Navy sweatshirt and sweatpants.
he saw Court and put up a hand.
Dude, forget her.
What?
I just checked on her. She's fine. But she does not want to talk to you. She's pissed. No, she's more than pissed.
Funny enough, it's not about the fact you stitched her up with a burst from a subgun.
It's about me killing her father.
Yep.
She wanted to do it.
Yeah, she did. You did the right thing, but she's not going to see that.
Ever. She saw it as her cross to bear for her brother, not yours to take from her. I just need to talk to her and...
No, man. Let it rest for now. Maybe somewhere down the road when it's not so raw you can...
Court started to push past Hightower, but the bigger man held him firm.
I'm looking out for you, brother. If it's going to work with you two, it sure as shit isn't going to happen today. I talked to her. I saw the look in her eyes. Nothing good will come from you going through that door right now, I can promise you that.
Stand down, Six. Let this rest. Court looked at Hightower a long moment, and then he stood down.
After several seconds more, he turned and began walking away, his shoulders low.
You out of here, brother?
Yep, Court replied. Getting on a launch back to Scotland in an hour.
Then what?
Court stopped, seemed to think about it.
Solo for a while, I guess. All this teamwork shit is a complicated pain in the ass.
Zack chuckled.
Watch your Six, Violator.
Court turned away and headed off up the passageway again.
You be careful out there, too.
He paused, then said, Night train. Zack pumped a fist into the air in excitement, but Court didn't look back to catch it. Epilogue. A light but steady rain fell out of the gray morning sky, over the blue and white fishing boat bobbing in the water next to an impossibly green spit of land. There was no marina here in Loch Crinan, just an old clabbered dock, half rotten through time, sticking out barely far enough for the trawler to tie on without running ashore. The weather here in the western coastal highlands was predictably dreary, and the captain walked around on deck securing lines to set sail without acknowledging the fact that his face and hair were drenched. He'd been living this life for 30 years, after all, and he knew no other. A mile or so to the southeast, a small twin turboprop took off from Oban Airport, banked through the gray rain, then disappeared in a puff of mist. While the captain continued preparing for the voyage, a man standing motionless on the foredeck of the trawler watched the aircraft fly away through the droplets dripping in front of his eyes off the hood of his raincoat. Court Gentry sighed. He didn't have any idea who was on that aircraft, but he imagined it being Zoya. This was doubtful.
More likely she was still on board the destroyer, or had already been spirited back to the United States on a CIA Gulfstream.
It had been a week since the attack, and he'd been lying low in nearby Oban, eating canned food in a simple hotel room, taking his antibiotics, and sulking. Court had been offered a ride back to the States, not on Hanley's jet. The DDO had resumed his earlier stance of remaining arm's length from the assets of Poison Apple. But Hanley had told Court he could go to Oban and fly out as soon as Transpo could arrange a lift for him. He got a text telling him when and where, and then he'd taken his battery out of his phone and thrown it in a river. He'd not declined so much as he just hadn't shown up at the prearranged place and time. Court would go on to his next destination alone. He leaned against the railing of the trawler, his spirits as dreary as the skies above. He'd gotten this boat captain to agree to take him through the last couple miles out of this lock, to a skiff that would be waiting a few miles out in the open ocean. The skiff would take him in turn back to its mothership, a Singapore-flagged evergreen dry goods hauler. Court had arranged for transportation through a broker that he knew from his time as an assassin for hire. He knew the broker would take his fee and pay off the Taiwanese crew and secure a ride for Court, at least as far as one of their ports of call. It was a useful service for a man like Gentry, one he used even now, though he was a CIA asset and could easily get transportation from them. But no, he had a thing against CIA Transpo at the moment. He felt like he was running away, away from Zoya. He thought about pursuing her back to D.C. He could get Brewer to arrange a meeting, though Brewer and Zoya weren't exactly on speaking terms at the moment. Still, he wondered if he could try one more time to convince Zoya that he wasn't the enemy. He told himself he might wonder that for a long time, because in the end, he decided to leave her in peace. She had made herself abundantly clear as to her wishes, and he would respect them, even if they killed him. The captain leaned out of the tiny navigation bridge and told Court they'd be leaving in 5 minutes. The boat bobbed, and Court looked to the land. The only colors anywhere in sight were blue, green, and gray. But some movement in the distance caught his attention. A white vehicle bounced on the muddy road in the distance, fast approaching the trawler tied to the dilapidated pier. Court cocked his head. The captain had said nothing about anyone else coming along for this ride, and there wasn't a thing out here other than rocky coastline and undeveloped pasture land. As it neared, Court determined the SUV to be a Toyota Land Cruiser that was at least 20 years old, and he had no idea who the hell could be inside it.
Hadn't they fucking killed all the bad guys already?
No, he told himself.
There are always more bad guys.
His left hand slowly unzipped his raincoat while his right hand hovered close to the pistol on his hip. Once the coat was open all the way, he knew he could just sweep it back and draw, faster than most anyone he'd ever encountered. But he did not draw. He just watched the Land Cruiser continue forward.
Captain!
He said it in a voice that told the grizzled older man he needed to stick his head back out of the nav bridge and pay attention to his passenger.
Aye?
Court bobbed his forehead towards the vehicle, and the captain said,
Not with me, mate. Haven't a clue?
Court kept watching.
You want me to shove off?
The captain asked. Court's training was telling him the answer was an obvious yes, but his curiosity told him he should wait and see who this was. The Land Cruiser skidded to a stop in the sloppy mud and gravel by the side of the pier, and then the passenger side door opened.
A pair of boots appeared slapping into the slop, with the wearer of the boots hidden behind the door of the SUV.
Court swept back his raincoat and put his hand on the butt of his pistol. Zoya Zakharova appeared when she stood up, then turned his way. She wore no raincoat, her heavy knit sweater was dry, but dampening by the second in the cool summer rain, and her brown hair, tied back behind her ears, shone with precipitation in just the first few seconds it was exposed to the sky. She walked slowly and gingerly through the mud, several steps closer to the pier, before she even looked up at the deck and saw Court standing there in his raincoat looking back. She continued up the pier, half dragging her right leg to keep from bending it on the side of her wounded hip. When she made it alongside the fishing boat, she looked up at him. With a deadpan expression and in a deadpan voice, she said, Surprise. Court could come up with no reply. You are wondering how I found you. Slowly he nodded, glanced quickly to the boat captain, and saw the man was back inside the closed navigation bridge and looking at some charts. He was well out of earshot. Zoya stepped a little closer. The Land Cruiser sat at idle behind her. The driver was a man who appeared to be in his 70s, and Court wondered if Zoya had hitchhiked here. She said, It seems you and I know the same stowaway broker. FYI, Antoine is not to be trusted. He has a thing for women. I called him, reminded him I'd used his services a few times, and he remembered me. I asked him about any clients in the area, and he told me about this passenger of his heading out on an evergreen via a fishing boat in Loch Crinan. Court hadn't taken his eyes off her. He could see the pain on her face from her hip wound, and it made him feel like shit. But the main thought going through his head right now was his confusion about what the hell she was doing here. Now you are wondering why I found you.
I am.
He realized he hadn't taken his hand off the grip of his Glock. He wondered if his body was able to detect that Zoya was indeed a threat to him, so it had stayed vigilant and prepared to react in case of an attack by her. Self-consciously, he lowered his hand to his side. She asked, Where are you going? He hadn't expected this. After a time, he said,
Wherever that ship takes me.
That's vague, even for you.
I need a little break, he said. When the time is right, I'll head back to D.C. I'll make my way back under Brewer's thumb before too long, I'm sure.
Just watch your back.
Court nodded. Will do. What about you?
She shrugged her muscular shoulders. I hope by me showing up like this, you didn't get the impression that everything is okay between us. I'm absolutely fucking furious with you about what you did.
Yeah, you conveyed that effectively in the dungeon of the castle.
She touched her right hip. And I'm not talking about this.
Court nodded. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Good. That's good. I don't know if I can ever forgive you, to be honest. I have my reasons for that, just like you have your reasons for what you did.
Court said nothing. He wasn't going to fight with her. He figured now he'd take some abuse, and then she'd shuffle back down to her ride, and she'd leave him forever.
But, she continued, I keep thinking that, for better or worse, the only person out there for someone like me is someone like you. Maybe not you, but someone like you.
There is no one like me, Zoya.
She sighed. That's exactly what I'm afraid of.
Court made a face that revealed his confusion.
He had next to no experience discussing relationships, but all this sounded so obscure he couldn't make out her point, if there even was one.
Zoya continued. And even though I'm still pissed, I wanted to come see you off before I fly back to D.C., out of Oban this afternoon.
He climbed off the boat now and stepped onto the pier in front of her. They stood a few feet apart a moment, then he moved closer and took her in his arms.
Carefully, please, she said.
Hey, Court said as he embraced her. I'm still pretty beat up myself.
We make quite a pair, don't we?
She said, and she hugged him back gently. After a time, Court stepped back and looked at her. Please take care of yourself, he said.
You too. I'll see you around.
She kept the dispassionate expression up for a few seconds more, and then, for the first time in a long time, he saw her smile. It wasn't much of a smile. It hinted at anger and suspicion and trouble ahead, but for now, at least, it was good enough for him. She reached out and touched the side of his face tenderly. Then she turned away and began heading back up the dock, while Court watched her go.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Mission Critical. Written by Mark Graney, performed by Jay Snyder. Executive producers Kristen Lang and Mike Charzik. Producer Chris Sacco. Copyright 2019 by Mark Strode Graney. Sound recording copyright 2019 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.